Good afternoon and welcome to Juno Afternoon for this sunny Tuesday, June 18th. My name is Martha Moore. I'll be your host, and we've got a great program lined up for you today. I'll be talking with Erwin Hertz of Haines, Alaska, about his book Journey Toward Eternal Life, Alaska Style. Ken Fix will fill us in on planetarium events, including the showing of the sci-fi retro movie Fantastic Voyage. We'll hear from Jordan Nigro about Only Fools Run at Midnight this weekend, and Jess Brown of Zach Gordon Youth Center will be talking about upcoming events. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, and more. Thanks for joining us. The forecast today calls for partly cloudy, isolated thunderstorms in the afternoon, high 65 to 71.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Oglala Sioux Tribe's president, Brian Brewer, was arrested Monday during a protest in the town of White Clay, Nebraska. The president and others were rallying against alcohol sales in the town located near their South Dakota homeland. As Charles Michael Ray reports, Brewer was taken into custody for an unrelated incident.
Tribal President Brian Brewer went peacefully during his arrest, but tensions between protesters and law enforcement quickly escalated. At least one officer drew his taser and pointed it into a protester's neck, but President Brian Brewer kept calm and the situation passed without further incident. Brewer says stopping beer sales in White Clay is only one of many ongoing issues that he's working to address.
If I close up White Clay today, it's not going to solve our problems in Pine Ridge, but we're going to send a message to our people, especially the younger ones, that we are concerned about the alcohol. You know, we are concerned about it. So it would be a small victory to close this place up, but it's not going to solve our problems. We know that.
The Sheridan County attorney later stated that Brewer was not arrested for protesting, rather for a warrant issued for a bad check he allegedly wrote in February of 2012. Brewer paid what he owed and the charges are dropped. Others, like Tribal Council Representative Robin Tapio, agree that alcohol is bad for Pine Ridge. Tapio says she's a recovering alcoholic who's been sober for 12 years. She says she lost her 16-year-old son to a drunk driving accident. At the same time, Tapio says protesting against White Clay liquor sales won't solve the problem.
Alcohol is a choice that we make, you know. So I did not support the walk up there because I just don't feel it's right.
Meanwhile, the Oglala Sioux Tribal Council passed a resolution to establish a port of entry at White Clay to curb the flow of liquor onto Pine Ridge. The council also approved a referendum that will put prohibition up to a tribal-wide vote in 2014. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has denied an appeal from the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe to stop exploratory drilling. A company wants to mine iron ore. Mike Simonson reports.
Bad River contended that the impact of drilling was not fully considered during the 10 days which the DNR had to decide on whether or not to allow GTAC to drill. DNR Waste Management Director Ann Coakley says the drilling will continue.
We didn't find anything in their letter that would cause us to halt the drilling. We still believe that Gilgibbick Taconite has met the requirements in the law for exploration. We did issue them a license, and we're not planning to revoke their license unless they don't follow their drilling plan.
Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says the DNR looked at the small picture. He says the impact of drilling is much larger.
And to be honest, to experience the absolute absurdity and insanity of watching a drilling rig go down into the earth when everybody there understands that everything we look at that drilling site, everything that we experience, all the trees, every drop of water that may be around is all slated for explosion.
GTAC is drilling its first borehole in Iron County now. It's expected to be finished in a few days. After that, at least another seven holes will be drilled in Iron and Ashland counties. Wiggins doesn't expect to take legal action, but says it is an option. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
The U.S. Supreme Court struck down Arizona's voter registration law in a 7-2 ruling Monday. Native Americans were part of a group that challenged voting provisions in federal elections adopted by the state in 2004, including proving citizenship when registering. Advocates say this discouraged voting by Native people. The Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan holds a Day of Healing and Remembering in June. The event recognizes the closing of the Mount Pleasant Indian Industrial Boarding School in the 1930s. The tribe says abuses at the school, which operated for decades, rippled through generations. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome back. You are tuned to Juno Afternoon. I'm Martha Moore, your host. I have on the line with me Erwin Hertz from Janes, Alaska, who authored the book Journey Toward Eternal Life, Alaska Style, Among the Hair, Hide, Guts, and Feathers. Erwin, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you for being on our program today.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, if I could characterize it in a sentence, is the story of your life and your faith and how they've been intertwined over the years. Is that a fair way of stating it?
Yes, God saved me from myself. But I've given everything to God. I've tried everything else. I give everything to God. Everything I am, I give it to Him, because the only reason I'm here is because He... The editor said, you know, who are you going to dedicate this book to? And I said, Jesus Christ, because if it wasn't for Him, I wouldn't even be alive. And that's physically or spiritually, I would not be alive. I would be gone. True story. Anyway, so I wrote this book. They said, why did you write it? I could not write it because of the miracles that God has done in my life, out-and-out miracles. Thank you.
So the book is divided into three parts, growing up in Montana, the 4 years in the Navy, and life in Alaska. And you were born in Charlo, Montana in 1936. Could you just describe for us that time, place, and the circumstances surrounding your childhood?
Well, I was born Charlo, Montana's on the Indian reservation, but it was a farm community, and it was amazing. I was born, my folks were German, but they were born in North Dakota. And my dad lost his farm in the Dust Bowl in Montana in the early 30s, and he had to do something. He borrowed some money and went to Montana to see if he could find some property up here to get away from the Dust Bowl. And that's how he come to be in Montana. He brought all he had left was two horses. He put them on a train and came up from North Dakota to get to Charlo, Montana. He just thought he didn't know anybody there. He just went there and started sharecropping, which is a pretty rough way to make a living. You just work on somebody's farm and share the crop. So that's how he started, but it was amazing because he was, failure was not an option because he'd failed once already and he borrowed money to get to Montana. And actually, when he's on the way on the train to Montana, he told the story just before he died, and some years ago, about 10 years ago. Anyway, he said that he was riding with the horses in that part of the train where the stock were, and these two guys came, and he knew that he was in trouble. He knew they was going to try and probably kill him and throw him off the train. But he knew that So, because it was a tough time in his life. So all he said was that he knew they was going to throw him off the train. He said, I found a 2x4, and he didn't say anything else. And all I know is he made it to Montana. I don't know where those other guys are. I'm sure they're along the way there somewhere. Anyway, but he started sharecropping there, and people said that property had never, ever produced like that. Because my dad had the mentality, you know, he had gone hungry. And he had two little boys from his first marriage, and his first wife died. And they found something in their family that they had something wrong with their health. And so his first wife died, left him with two boys, 1 year old and 2 year old. Then he married the lady's sister, that his first wife, and he was married to her for 6 months, and she died. And my God, then the people started suspecting foul play. And it was horrible for him to be going through that. Here they suspected him of killing his second wife. Anyway, he met my mother. She was from another family there, and she was a family that they were German too in Montana. My mother's father was a officer in the German army in the First World War. Anyway, so he met that family, and there was 12 girls and 2 boys in that family, and my mother was one of the older girls. And she was actually taking care of his children, his 2 boys, when he caught the train to take his horses to Montana.
And your childhood, it was pretty primitive conditions you were growing up in, but it sounded like you have had lots of good times.
Yeah, we did. We never looked at it as hard times. Hard times was just an experience, and it was exciting, too, because of the things that we did for recreation. And it was an amazing time in my life. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I remember when we were growing up, mom would go shopping on Saturday, and we would be home doing chores, and we always would rope the calves and ride them for like bucking horses, you know, when we were just kids. But my dad did not let us do that when he was home.
So when you were 10 years old, you experienced what you call a big God event. And I might add that this was the first of several in your life. Tell us about that experience.
Yes, I will. I'd love to. Anyway, when I was growing up, I tried to say a perfect prayer. I swear I don't know what a perfect prayer meant, because we were taught by the nuns in the Catholic Church. And they were, boy, those ladies, they weren't no sissies, man. Us farm kids, we were all athletes. We were all athletes, and they would come out and play with us, you know, in their long habitats they wore. they could outrun us sometimes. They were amazing. Anyway, that's how I come to be praying, and that's, I think, God honored that in my life. So when I was 10 years old, I had some good friends. We all went fishing, and they were the guys I was always riding calves, and would even saddle up the boar pig and ride him. Anyway, we rode everything because we wanted to be rodeo people. Anyway, so we were always going fishing or something, and just one day we got our bicycles, and there was a little store and a creek down below this highway that we would go fishing down there. So, but we would ride our bicycles that 2 miles down there and pick up pop bottles and beer bottles along the road and turn them into a little store there to get a pop to drink, you know, because we always did that little store. They would give us a few cents for a bottle, empty bottle. So anyway, so we went there, and there was like about four or five of us, and so they had already gone in, got a pop, and I came, and I was the last one to go in, and when I went in, I got a pop and came out, and as I came out, there was a field right by the store, and there was a guy standing out there, and he was looking right at me. He was probably about good 30 yards away, but he was standing out in the field, but he didn't look like anybody from the farm. You know, we all had overhauls on or something, and he was out there in like not farm clothes, but like casual clothes. He was standing out there looking right at me, and it was amazing. And I walked over to the fence, and I climbed through the fence and walked over to where he was standing. And I walked up to him, and it was amazing. He had the bluest eyes. I'd never seen eyes like that, I swear. I mean, I didn't know that he was looking into my soul, or even if I had a soul, but I felt like this man was looking right into my soul. And he looked at me, and he walked right up to me, and he said, "Jesus loves you." I had never, ever heard that. You know, you don't say "I love you" in a German family, even. And for somebody to say "I love you," that Jesus loves you, I had, even from the nuns, they didn't ever talk about Jesus or teach angels or anything. And so I was shocked. I didn't know what to say. And he said that Jesus loves you. And then the guys were on the other side of the fence or getting on their bicycles to go. And I told him I had to go. And so I walked back over and climbed through the fence, and my buddies were there on their bicycles. They said, "What were you doing out there?" And I said, "I was talking to that guy." And they said, "What are you talking about? There's nobody out there but you." I already knew that this was not an ordinary person. There was no way that even me at 10 years old, I had never seen anybody like that. His blue eyes were absolutely shocking. They were shocking. And it seemed like there was a power there, but it was nothing like at 10 years old, you know. I was amazed and shocked too. And when they said this, I did not say a word because I already knew. I didn't even think about it being an angel until some years later.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Erwin Hertz talking to us about his book, Journey Toward Eternal Life, Alaska Style. And we're running out of time here. Erwin's lived in Alaska for over 50 years. And if you want to find out about his years in Alaska, you'll have to pick up the book. It's quite a fascinating and very eventful life that you have led, Erwin.
Yes, and I can't even explain a lot of it. When people get the book, I said, please, if you have any questions, please ask me, because I'll try to tell you what happened at that certain thing, at that certain time.
So where can someone find this book if they want to get it?
Well, you can get it on the internet at Amazon, or you can get it through my name too, Erwin Hertz, and it's on Inspiring Voices too, and it's at different places, but I think Amazon's the cheapest.
Okay, thank you, Erwin. Thanks so much for being on the program. Again, the title of the book is Journey Toward Eternal Life, Alaska Style, Among the Hair, Hide, Guts, and Feathers.
Thank you.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. My name is Martha Moore, and I have Ken Fix with me here in the studio to talk about what's happening at the planetarium. Ken, what do we have going on at the planetarium?
Hi, Martha. How you doing?
Good.
Okay, tonight we'll be returning to the retro sci-fi movie schedule, which we do every summer. This will be the third summer that's been running. Now we're doing movies from the 60s instead of the last two summers where we were kind of aimed at the 50s. And tonight's presentation is going to be Fantastic Voyage. It's a 1966 sci-fi classic. It's about a Soviet scientist that knows the secret for indefinite miniaturization. Both sides, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, of course, this is set in the time when the Cold War is still going on. They both have miniaturization technology, but they can't keep it in place longer than an hour. So the Soviet scientist is injured. He's got an inoperable brain injury, and a team of scientists has shrunk down to microscopic size and injected into his body in order to find the damage that's in his brain and fix it and then get out.
So give us the time and the place of the showing.
Okay, it's at the Marie Drake Planetarium at 6:30 p.m. tonight, and we're on Glacier Avenue in the Marie Drake Middle School building. If you're coming from the valley, you make the left turn at the breakwater, make the first right turn, go past the fences. As soon as you see the fences stop on the right-hand side, that should be the Marie Drake Planetarium in our building. And if you went and passed the Blockbuster, you went too far.
Okay. Is there an entrance fee for this?
No, it's all free. We are going to be have some popcorn available if people want to purchase that. It's going to be $1. So we will have that. It's a very relaxed atmosphere. Like I said, this is the third year that we've done this, so we encourage people to come, bring your kids. These are age-appropriate movies for children. There may be a couple of scary things here and there, but they're, you know, really nothing beyond that. You can bring lawn chairs, blankets, whatever. We run a very relaxed atmosphere during the summer schedule.
Okay, great. And I've heard, I haven't seen the movie myself, but I've been told it's very popular among teenage boys.
Oh, because of Raquel Welch in a wetsuit? All right. Well, it's, okay. Well, maybe there's a little bit of that factor in there, but again, this was the 60s. She does have an important function as a scientist in the movie, so she's not just there for window dressing. But no, the movie is actually very good for its time. It won two special effects for art and set design. And it's still kind of emulated throughout modern presentations. We've had a movie called Inner Space with Dennis Quaid, where Martin Short's the person that has a miniaturized person injected inside him. So that's what Dennis Quaid was inside of him in that. So miniaturization is, it's an interesting topic, but there's a lot of science that's wrong with it, and there's a lot of reasons why you can't really do it. First off, where does the mass go when you shrink something down? It still weighs the same. So, things would be incredibly heavy. So nobody addresses that. And there's also a few things that are wrong in the movie, but a lot of people think that Isaac Asimov wrote it, but he was tasked with writing it from the screenplay, and since the movie production was going rather slowly, he finished the book before the movie came out in 66. So a lot of people think that Isaac Asimov wrote the original story, but that's not true. He didn't. And he was trying to fix some glaring problems with the story, whereas in this movie, the ship is left inside the guy's body, and they said, well, the white blood cell eats it, but those individual atoms are still going to enlarge, and that would kill a person in the process. But in the book, he actually has the white blood cell follow them out through the optic nerve, so there's a big pile of shards sitting in this control room floor at the end of the book, but that's not what they show in the movie. And there's also an interesting question of the missing laser gun, because there's a laser gun that the doctor's going to use to operate on this man from the inside, and by the end of the movie, the laser gun's gone. Nobody's got it, but it's like, if that thing expanded, that would be all over for the guy, too. So it's very entertaining, though. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of fun, and maybe best not to overthink it.
Yeah. The second movie that we'll run this summer is going to be on July 16th. We're running Planet of the Apes, the original, with Charlton Heston. I don't know what exactly I'm going to pick for August yet. I'm thinking either staying in the 60s or doing something from the 70s. And once we get to the fall, back in September, we start to return to our original presentations where we do science and, you know, run the star ball and everything and talk about, you know, the stars and whatnot. We'll be revisiting my Hermes and Mercury show probably in October. We've had a probe around Mercury for the last few years. It's called MESSENGER, and it's been sending back an incredible amount of survey data. So I'll go over the science involved with MESSENGER once we get to October. But when I did the original show in the fall of 2010, that probe hadn't gotten to Mercury yet. It was about a month or two away. So I kind of like to repeat it and go over all the planetary science, but that'll be in the fall. So for the summertime, though, we're sticking with the movie schedule. Again, it's a very relaxed atmosphere. Everybody's welcome. Free admission. Come on down. See a movie on the Stardome.
So where can someone go to find out about all the events that take place at the planetarium?
Oh, our website is www.mariedrakeplanetarium.org, and that will give you anything that's upcoming as far as events and also a few other links and a chronology of things that we've done in the past down at the planetarium.
So once again, tonight at 6:30 p.m. at Marie Drake Planetarium, and this is Fantastic Voyage, and sounds like it's a good time and good family fun. So thanks for coming in, Ken.
Thank you very much, Martha.
Okay, we'll be back with my next guest after a short break.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 18th of June, 2013. It's the birthday of musician-songwriter Paul McCartney, born in Liverpool, England, 1942. When he was 14 and learning to play a left-handed guitar, he met a local art student named John Lennon. They formed a skiffle band, called themselves the Quarrymen, and played for years in a little club in Liverpool called the Cavern. After a little success, they met Brian Epstein, who became their manager. He suggested they replace their current drummer, a guy by the name of Pete Best, with a young man named Ringo Starr. By 1963, the band, which had changed its name to The Beatles, was the most popular rock and roll group in England. In February of 1964, they took America by storm with the appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. The Guinness Book of World Records lists McCartney as the best-selling composer in popular music history. His song, Yesterday, is the most recorded ever, with 2,200 versions. On this day in 1815, Napoleon Bonaparte lost his final major battle near Waterloo Village in Belgium. One of the most famous figures in history, remembered by his first name only, Napoleon is the subject of some 45,000 books. Waterloo was Napoleon's attempt at a comeback. He had been defeated by the British and was in exile on the island of Elba, but he grew restless and devised a plan to march north with his army and attack the English and Prussian armies. A heavy rain fell, delayed the attack, allowing the Prussians to bring in reinforcements. Napoleon's army was soundly defeated. Thousands of fatalities resulted. He abdicated and went to live on the island of St. Helena off the coast of Africa. The word Waterloo came to mean an impossible struggle or decisive and final defeat. It's the birthday of novelist Amy Bloom, born in New York City, 1953. She was in her 30s practicing psychotherapy, raising two children, when she realized she wanted to be a serious writer. She said, "I've spent a lot of time listening to people, and I am endlessly intrigued by relationships, particularly by the gap between what people say and what they truly feel, and the gap between what they do and what they really want." Her books include Love Invents Us, Away, and Where the God of Love Hangs Out. And here's a poem by Thomas Lux, "To Help the Monkey Cross the River." To help the monkey cross the river, which he must cross by swimming for fruits and nuts, to help him, I sit with my rifle on a platform high in a tree, same side of the river as the hungry monkey. How does this assist him? When he swims for it, I look first upriver. Predators move faster with the current than against it. If a crocodile is aimed from upriver to eat the monkey, and an anaconda from downriver burns with the same ambition, I do the math, algebra, angles, rate of monkey, croc, and snake speed, and if it looks as though the anaconda or the croc will reach the monkey before he attains the river's far bank, I raise my rifle and fire 1, 2, 3, even 4 times into the river just behind the monkey to hurry him up a little. Shoot the snake? The crocodile? They're just doing their jobs. But the monkey has little hands like a child's, and the smart ones in a cage can be taught to smile. A poem by Thomas Lux to help the monkey cross the river from his collection, The Cradle Place, published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping professionals and businesses look their best when people search for them online. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us next time.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Martha Moore. I'm here with Jordan Nigro to talk about the Only Fools Run at Midnight Run. So this run is certainly an institution here in Juno. How many years has it been going on?
This will be our 29th year. SAIL hasn't done it for 29 years, but it's been happening for 29 years.
And it is a fundraiser?
It is a fundraiser. It's a fundraiser for SAIL, Southeast Alaska Independent Living, and we actually have 3 races going on simultaneously Saturday night. So it starts here in Juneau at 11:59, and then it will also be happening in Ketchikan and Sitka at the same time because we have offices in those places as well.
And so what sort of things do these funds support?
Southeast Alaska Independent Living, we're an independent living center, and so we work with folks of all ages and all disabilities to help them to be more independent, whatever that looks like for them. It can be a ramp into their house, you know, helping them to get that set up, or it can be getting them out on Eagle Crest skiing. A lot of people are familiar with our ORCA program and see folks out skiing in the winter and things like that, and also, you know, hiking and kayaking and all that stuff. So it really varies, but we really try to work with folks whatever their needs are.
How far is the run?
The run is a 5K, and it can be a 5K run, or the walk is just a mile, I believe.
And is this for all ages?
Yep, all ages participate, and a lot of times families do it together. We have a lot of families that come. Sometimes we've had families come where a little baby is dressed up in costume strapped to mom or dad. So there's lots of great costumes come out, and that's part of the fun of Fool's Run is people really get into it and get very creative.
So can you describe some notable costumes or groups in the past?
Oh, let's see. We had one person come completely painted in silver one year. That was pretty cool. Last year, we had a little girl that was dressed up as a penguin who was about the cutest thing ever. We also have lots of centipedes. So that's when folks all get together and do one big costume. And I think last year the Department of Voc Rehab came as just a bunch of friends that work together. They came as a salad, so we had lettuce and tomato, and and you have to be, the thing with the centipede is you're supposed to be attached somehow. And we've had lifeguards and, yeah, lots of different stuff.
Are there serious competitors in this run, or is it just purely for fun?
Oh, there's always a few folks that run it way faster than everybody else, but mostly, you know, the race is really for fun, and everybody's out there just having a good time.
So give us the particulars about when, where, and how to sign up.
So the best way to register is actually online, which is on our website, sailinc.org, www.sailinc.org. But you can also pick up registrations at, I'm just going to make sure I don't miss anybody, at JRC, the Alaska Club, First Bank, Pavitt Health and Fitness, or the Nugget Outfitter, or you can come to the SAIL office, which is at 3225 Hospital Drive. So if you want to do it in person, you can do it that way. away and turn them into any of those spots. But like I said, I think online is probably the quickest and easiest these days. And registration online and all these spots will close Thursday at 5 o'clock because Friday we all spend the day rolling the T-shirts and getting everything together. So and the first 500 people to register get a free T-shirt.
Oh, great. So typically, what kind of turnout do you get?
We get, let's see, probably anywhere from about 500 to 700 people. I think last year we had a little over 700, so.
Cool. So, well, let's hope for good weather and a successful event. And thanks, Jordan, for coming in.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Rushing where angels fear to tread, and so I come to you, my love, my heart above my head. Oh, I see the danger there, but if there's a chance for me, then I don't care. Fools rushing where wise men never go, but wise men never fall in love. So how are they to know when we met? Girl, I felt my life begin. So open up your heart and let me rush in.
This is Bird Note. The Organization for Tropical Studies, or OTS, celebrates its 50th anniversary this month. It operates three field research stations in Costa Rica, and we asked Dr. Gordon Oriens, a past president, to reflect on its contributions over the years.
I think that the most important contribution of OTS has been education, and there are now more than 8,000 alumni. These alums are the cadre of the leading tropical biologists in the country today, and they have trained most of the next generation of tropical biologists in the United States. So OTS has had an immense contribution in terms of education. And if you've just been a temperate zone biologist as I was, I know my first trip to Costa Rica, it blew my mind. The tropics are incredibly important for a number of reasons. In terms of biological diversity, the tropics are where the greatest richness is. You know, Costa Rica has more species of birds than all of North America put together. Many of our birds from North America winter in the tropics, and so the life cycles of the species we care about here, a very large proportion of them, depend on their having suitable migratory stopovers and wintering grounds in the tropics.
We're linked with the tropics in many, many ways. The research and graduate courses being conducted through OTS help us understand just how. See photos and learn more at birdnote.org.
Will computers become conscious? Can string theory help us travel to the stars? Join us, Seth Shostak and
Molly Bentley and
KTOO News, Friday nights at 8 for Big Picture Science.
Big Picture Science gives you a weekly look into the latest developments in science and technology, straight from the people perched on the precarious cutting edge.
So think big, broaden your horizons, and get the scoop with Big Picture Science.
Friday nights at 8 o'clock on KTOO News, Juneau.
You are tuned to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Martha Moore, and I'm here with Jess Brown to talk about what's on the schedule at the Zach Gordon Youth Center this summer. Jess, could you please tell us what something about the summer camps coming up?
Sure. Well, many of you know that Zach Gordon Youth Center offers a bunch of recreational opportunities year-long. In the summer, things sort of shift. A lot of our older teens tend to get jobs, or they go back to the villages to fish. And we end up doing a lot of summer camps. And so we offer summer camps all summer long on a week-by-week basis. And coming up, we've got a great camp, the Adventure Treasure Chest Camp, which will be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of next week. And instead of being five short days, it's three long days where we just get outside and have fun. We'll go kayaking out of Amalga Harbor, and we'll get on the ropes course out at the Eagle Valley Center, and we'll even venture into Shaman Island with those super low tides next week. Additionally, we've got some fishing camps. We've got H2 Awesome, which is one of my favorites. We partner with the Orca program, and we provide an accessible camp for anyone of all abilities, and we do a lot of fun water activities for that one. Additionally, we've got an Arts Around Town camp and a Fun Runners camp, which is also one of my favorites, where we do all sorts of fun running activities for kids, and we'll incorporate some stretching and some just different little drills, and adventure runs is really what it boils down to, of course. And then our last camp of the summer is Wilderness Walks, where we usually spend most of our time picking berries and munching on them the whole way along.
So who's eligible to sign up for these camps?
That's a great question. Most of our camps range from age 7 to 13. So the Adventure Treasure Chest camp next week is 9 to 13. But the fishing camps are a little younger. They're 7 to 11. And I will say that we only have one fishing camp spot left right now. So if fishing's what you want to do, I would call up right now.
So the deadlines for signing up is just first come, first serve?
Absolutely. We have 10 spots available for each camp, and we also have some waiting list spots. So if you really want to get your kid into a fishing camp or whatever it is, really just call us up and we'll see what's available. And if we can't get you into the camp, we'll definitely put you on the wait list.
Do the camps cost money?
They do. Most of them are $80 per week, and that's including tax. It's a great deal because if you're familiar with the Zach Gordon Youth Center, you know that it's a drop-in facility, so you can drop your kids off a little early on your lunch hour, and they can hang out, they can play ping pong, pool with each other, and then the camp will start at 1 o'clock, and it goes until 4:30, and it works out really well where the kids can get back and let some of that chaotic energy out and play with each other a little bit longer, and parents can just come over right after work.
So for the center, is there an age limit?
There is. We do end up serving youth of all ages up until 21. It's free for kids and families, and adults can come and interact with their kids for free as well. But if kids are not supervised by an adult, they have to be 9 years old. Yeah.
Okay. And then if they're younger than 9, their adult can come with them, their parent or whatever.
Absolutely. We've got all sorts of fun stuff. We've got a climbing wall. We've got a gym, a basketball court, pool, ping pong. We've got some fun stuff outside right now. We've got a garden that's just loving the sunshine, drinking it in.
So how many workers do you have over there working with these kids?
We've got about 6 or 7 of us, and we just love the summertime because it means we get to get outside with the kids.
Great. So how can people find out more about these camps if they didn't remember everything you just said?
Yeah. You can call us up at 586-2635, and that's after 11 in the morning because we open up at 11, so we won't get any messages before then. And if you don't want to call, you can always just look for us online. If you go to juno.org, and you can either type in Juno /park rec/youth center, or you can just go on the juno.org and sort of navigate through the different tabs under recreation and then under the youth center.
So are all these camps just daytime activities, or there are overnight activities?
They're all daytime. So with the exception of the Adventure Treasure Chest, which is next week's, all the rest start at 1 p.m. and then they go until 4:30 p.m. Next week's Adventure Treasure Chest camp, because we are doing such fun stuff and it'll be a little bit of a drive, it starts earlier. It starts at 9 and it ends at 2:30 in the afternoon. So we can actually get out to where we're going and spend some time there.
Well, sounds like a great thing for the youth, and thanks for coming in. So, again, if you want to find out more, go to the CBJ Parks and Rec website, and you can see what all of these camps are all about.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Jess.
Fresh Air Weekend is like a best of fresh air, with all our favorite arts and pop culture interviews of the week, and none of the wars, plagues, pestilence, and other horrendous things that we try so hard to explain on our daily show. It's like what fresh air would be if we lived in a perfect world. Join us for Fresh Air Weekend.
Saturdays at 2 on KTOO News.
Starting on Monday, tune in at 10 a.m. to hear Here and Now, a two-hour program taking the place of Talk of the Nation, which is ending production. Science Friday will still air as always. With Here and Now, you can expect the best in NPR News Magazine programming with breaking news, in-depth stories, and unique features. To find out more, go to ktoo.org.
And that's it for today's Juno Afternoon. I'm Martha Moore, your host. Thanks for joining me, and thanks to all the guests today and for Jeff Brown for helping me out in the studio. To listen to any of today's interviews, visit the KTLO.org website under Local Programs and Juno Afternoon. Please join us tomorrow at 3 p.m. The show will be hosted by Laurie Scandling. She'll talk with Angela Chapin about the Alaska Military Youth Academy. Heather Parker from the Learning Connection will talk about tomorrow night's naturalization and immigration information session. She'll talk to Jill Whites, whose team is one of five finalists selected by Outside Magazine for an adventure grant. That Writer's Almanac, music, and more tomorrow at 3 on KTOO-FM. The weather for today, partly cloudy, lows around 52. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, highs 68 to 74. You're listening to KTOO-FM in Juneau, Alaska.
Information gathered from these programs provided the U.S. government with critical leads to help prevent over 50 potential terrorist events.
The director of the National Security Agency defends surveillance programs.
Today is Tuesday, June 18th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. NSA Director Keith Alexander tells Congress the surveillance programs are subject to extraordinary oversight.
We'll talk about that with one of the House Intelligence Committee members, Republican Matt Thornberry of Texas.
Also this hour, a glimpse into how...